four doors for more whores. Fantastic. Sure. That's a sticker for James's car that he's very keen on. All right, we have Catherine Grenfell with us. It is a Monday morning. It is already the 25th of November.
Oh, my goodness.
Jesus. Black Friday this week.
Yeah, I don't do that.
I don't participate in any of that shit either. But in America, it's Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Right? Which is, I think, a much better idea. Like, you get around the table with your nearest and dearest and you say something you're thankful for. But no, yeah. We take all the shit holidays like Halloween and Black Friday. Yes. We borrow those. Yeah. We don't take the nice ones.
I mean, we should be doing the Thanksgiving every day.
I think
there's my hippie vibes going
on. But being grateful, yes. Right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Okay, so I always give Oprah Winfrey a very hard time because she used to say things like, if you just believe in it, you can be it and all this
absolutely.
Kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
No, it's nonsense. I mean, like, she's ruined many children by turning them into unhappy adults as a result of the fact that their dreams haven't come true.
Yes.
And she's sitting there in Montecito with, billions of dollars.
Yeah.
But she did get that right, that gratitude thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gratitude. And I don't think it was her idea. It's like, this is ancient philosophy.
Yeah. And it's something you can add into your journal, by the way.
Oh, there we go.
You can. That's what you can actually start off with.
By the time you leave here, you may have turned me into a fucking hippie.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
All right. So a couple of things we've got to get to this morning. First of all, someone sent me a picture of this toilet scale. This is an actual thing that apparently they've made. You wonder what you could buy your family member for Christmas.
Oh my gosh.
A toilet seat scale shows how much weight is lost after you take a dump.
I quite like this vibe. It's not even about the weight thing. It's just about, when you take a great shit.
What makes it so great?
It's so fantastic. You just feel like you have lost weight.
Yeah.
And it's not about I'm not precious about losing weight thing. It's just
a release.
A release.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Just this extra unnecessary,
I've
uncomfortable.
The tank.
It's fantastic. I love that. I wonder if it works though. I'd love to check it out.
I think it's a gimmick, but there we go. If you're looking for a gift idea, everybody,
you come out of the bathroom and you're like, guys, today was the
whole
best
kilogram.
Best dump.
I managed to evacuate an entire kilogram. Isn't that great? All right. So you were telling me that you gifted yourself, because we played a clip from the doctors and they talked about all kinds of front and back issues, right?
Yes.
And you said you gifted yourself on this process of kind of
my self-love and self-care.
Right. You gave yourself a colonoscopy as a present.
Yes.
What a present.
It was an amazing present. So it's a little bit of a downer. My dad died of colon cancer.
That's a serious thing.
And so
part of
this self-care, and I think that often we think that self-care is like having a bubble bath and, just chilling out and whatever.
It's making sure you don't get
self-care,
colon cancer.
Self-care, absolutely. Yeah. And so I had a list of things that I wanted to do, and that was at the top of the list. And it just so happened that when I went to the gastroenterologist, I was like, what date? And I think it was like 2 days before my birthday. And I was like, what a great gift.
But
birthday present to myself.
So you said, I feel like I want a colonoscopy.
Yeah,
and they said, well, people don't usually ask for these.
Yes,
they get
they
told.
They did. And yeah. But I did say, my dad died of colon cancer. Okay. I'm getting to that
time.
It's a
bit of context.
Yeah. I did give a I don't just feel like a colonoscopy randomly.
You know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to let them put a camera up my asshole and explore my intestine.
And it's quite a thing. I mean, it's also that.
But were you're awake?
No. That one you're under.
Okay.
And which I'm grateful for.
Sure.
I don't know if I really want
to
be
awake for
someone shoving something up my ass.
No.
It's not my vibe. I know it's like a lot of people, that's cool.
Sure.
It's just really not my vibe. Yeah. So they found nothing, which was amazing.
Great relief.
It was a great relief. And let me tell you, you've got to drink all of this stuff beforehand
to
release everything in your bowels. And that was also like quite amazing. You are clean.
You're just
clean.
Basically like a new shiny car.
I was exactly that.
All right. Well, there's a conversation we didn't know we were going to have this morning.
Absolutely.
Take a look at this inspiring TED Talk. All right. This is my favorite TED Talk of all time.
Wow.
And yeah, I think you'll enjoy it too. So if you need some inspiration this morning, you've come to the right place. Have a look at this.
I'm fat. Patriarchy. I'm lazy, greedy, unhealthy, irresponsible.
And then?
I'm fat. I am the elephant in the room.
Very inspiring. I feel like that's the best.
Gareth, I feel like that's the best TED Talk I've ever seen. That was like completely edited and made for you. Just so you can prove all your fat points.
I didn't edit it, but I wish I had.
Yeah.
I kind of, whoever did that, I'm very proud of you. It's just her with like mouth breathing and then I'm fat. And then this is more mouth breathing. It was great. I'm really, really impressed with that. Greatest TED Talk ever. I don't watch TED Talks, but that one I'll watch again. You want to watch it again?
No, I don't want to watch
it again. No, okay. I didn't think you'd like it as much as
no,
I did.
No.
But I loved it. Why is she wearing my tablecloth, says Congo Chris. Well, she put a belt around it. Like, give her a bit of credit. She's very fashion forward. All right, then we talked about this Jaguar ad.
Yes.
Okay, so you said you don't really care about cars, which is fine.
Yeah.
And advertising also, you know, some of it's good, some of it's bad, so what? But in this case, this one has got an enormous amount of like,
oh my God, they've done their job.
And noise. And yeah. I mean, you could argue that this is the whole job of advertising is to get attention. But I don't know whether it's good attention. Like, there is such a thing as bad advertising. And there's certainly such a thing as bad publicity.
I think it is fantastic.
You like the ad?
I love the ad. They are completely, and I think that this is the amazing thing about advertising. Number one, they are coming up with a whole new target market. So your age, Elon Musk vibes, they are all having like a complete meltdown about it.
No. It's a terrifically shit ad that has nothing to do with a car. It could just as well have been for scented candles. It could just as well have been for adult nappies. Mm? It could just as well have been for a pen.
It's fine.
It's
but everyone is talking about the brand.
Because it's so shit. And then, I mean,
it's only a certain age group that is saying it's shit.
No, but the age group you're talking about, this new age group of people, they can't afford cars. They don't have any money.
No, I think that there are people out there that do have money. And those are the people that they're targeting.
We'll see. The proof will be in the pudding.
It will be.
Because sales are the important thing here, right? So if they sell 100,000 cars based on this new ad campaign, yeah, I'll be impressed. But here's the response from Jaguar themselves, because now obviously they have to deal with the second wave of criticism.
Yes.
So here's a screenshot of something that's going on with that, which I think is quite interesting. Jaguar boss says, criticism of new advert is vile, hatred, and intolerance. And then someone says, translation, I made an advert so bad that it may bring down my whole company, and now I'm having a tantrum. You don't agree.
I don't. I think that they have paid for a certain amount of advertising and gotten probably a million times that.
Yes, but they are in the business of selling cars. If they were in the attention-seeking business, absolutely, I'd agree with you.
Oh, my God. All of the cars are attention-seeking.
Yeah, but
they are all attention-seeking.
I feel like you may have a point here that I'm going to have to concede. Yeah, I do think this is going to affect them kind of badly, though, because they are – you know what people are looking for when they're buying a car. And it could be a number of things, but I certainly don't think it's like this weird, androgynous, bizarre – means nothing, dystopian
Do you think if you are a Jaguar driver, and obviously neither you or I are Jaguar drivers, because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I definitely can't afford it. But if I, and I know that people get super obsessed about car brands, et cetera. If I am passionate about it because I have a Jaguar or it is my dream car because of such and such things, you buy it because, I mean, obviously you buy it because of the name as well, but it's safe or it's this and it's this. You're still going to buy the car because you absolutely love it. This ad campaign is not going to make you not buy the car. I don't think so. I really don't. I don't think, I think if you really want something, you're going
to
buy it.
Let's see what everybody's, maybe they agree with you. Maybe I need to shut up and learn something from this. So I see here Jaguar's stock price has only fallen by 75% since July. That's not so great.
Okay, but that's before the advertising campaign, so we can't.
They were already into this woke shit by then. Snai says it's nice to have a co-host that disagrees with Gareth. Absolutely, and I'm thrilled. Listen, I love it.
Good.
No one disagrees with me anymore. It's very hard to find people to argue with. Fag you are. Let zero from Budweiser says Bitcoin Boot. Go woke, go broke. The ad sucks. Jaguar drivers have always been stereotyped, but now it's gone too far, says you. What engine and safety features has the car got, says Percy. And
I mean, if we were prepared for this topic, we would have those answers for you.
No, but
we don't know much about cars.
No, that doesn't matter, I think this is about, you're right in this respect too. It's about the ad. And of course, the brand, and we can discuss the nature of, you know, the cars that Jaguar's brought out in the last 10 years or whatever. But I don't know that anyone's going to necessarily sell the car if they've already got it. But I think advertising does persuade people.
Yeah.
And this may have the opposite effect, that it may persuade people to rather look at another car. That's maybe what I'm thinking. Certainly the people who could afford or would buy Jaguars.
Yeah, maybe.
Let's see. Because again, we will tell in a couple of months, right?
Yeah.
If it gets completely blown out of the water and it's a huge success, then I'll have to have you back to go, nah, 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 I told you so.
Absolutely.
And I will. I'll get you back to do that.
But I also think, I mean, the advertising whole perspective has been done here, that they only bought a certain amount of advertising and it's they have gotten
hundreds of millions of dollars.
Look at us two uncar people talking about it here in South Africa.
No, you're spot on.
Yeah.
All right, it's Karen on. Very good. All right, so listen, Karen Morn has written a book, and I want you to know all about this book. And I thought, well, what better way to get talking about it than to bring her on? You're a big fan of Karen as well.
I am a fan. I follow her on social media.
Excellent.
So incredible.
She's, of course, an award-winning journalist, a documentary producer, and a best-selling author. The book is called I Will Not Be Silenced, and no one's got any chance of that, Karen Morn. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm so happy to see Kath as well.
Oh, okay. So lovely to see
you. I'm coming out of a retirement village in Pinelands, guys. I'm with my parents, hence the decor.
I was going to say,
very nice.
Of me in the background.
I was going to say, you're not old enough to be in a retirement village. What the hell's going on
here?
Well,
you know, I mean, I hope the screen is right.
Yeah, it's fine.
But basically, this was the place when all the drama happened that I stayed for quite a few months because I felt like I was the safest here because no one gets anything past people in a retirement village. Everyone here knows exactly what's going on at all times. Yes. So
they know which cars are driving past.
Exactly. You are 100% safe in a retirement village.
Okay. So Karen, let's just sketch the scenario for everybody because you've written books before. I mentioned that you probably, for many people in this country, came to prominence in your excellent and unparalleled coverage of like Oscar's trial 10 years ago, which is really where a lot of people were hanging on your every word because you were in the story. You knew all the people involved. You kind of had an ability to explain who was who in the zoo and what happened and how the evidence is being brought and all that stuff, because we were obsessed at that time. And I mean, you've done lots of other stuff that is noteworthy and award-winning, but the thing that I suppose is most alarming to people is that you weren't able to just be a journalist, you weren't able to just report stories, because there were actually people who wanted to silence you. You've had people trying to take you to court and go through legal routes, but there are also people who wanted to kill you and wanted to remove you because you were a massive impediment to them being able to carry on doing the bad things that they were doing. So just give us an idea of what brought about the desire to write a book about this and to relive some of those very, very traumatic experiences that you've had. And the difficulty of not just being a reporter and journalist, but actually being a public figure who other public figures wanted to get out of the way.
I think the thing was, with my situation, it was so bizarre. I mean, you literally had former President Jacob Zuma falsely accusing me of being leaked, unlawfully leaked his medical records by mm-hmm. the NPA in a way that he said implicated prosecutor Billy Downer, his corruption prosecutor, in violations of the NPA Act, and saying that I should go to jail for 15 years for that. And you end up in this situation where, like, a court that you've been in since you were like a kid, because I was covering this since 2009, I was like a baby journalist. You're now sitting in a criminal dock and Carl Niehaus and Mzwanele Manyi are like filming you and Julius Malema is happily retweeting pictures of you in the dock. And it's this whole like weird shaming experience. And, you know, as the courts showed, the courts that I fundamentally believe in showed that was ultimately, you know, an abusive prosecution. It was bought with an ulterior purpose. It was bought with the desire to delay his corruption trial mm-hmm. by, you know, focusing this attempt on the removal of Billy Downer, who is an excellent prosecutor, didn't deserve any of the stuff that happened to him. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately the court found that it was to silence my journalism because I'd sort of been there from the beginning. So what happens a lot with Jacob Zuma's litigation is that his lawyers will often radically misrepresent what has happened in the entire very long history of this case. So they'll focus on judgments that ruled in their favor, but not mention the fact that those judgments were overturned on appeal. They'll focus on these conspiracy elements and then not focus on the fact that those were essentially found to be highly speculative and baseless by the SCA. And I think that the fact that I was the last remaining journalist who was going, that's not what happened. I think that probably irritated them a little bit. And Zuma himself said that I had perpetuated this false narrative about him utilizing this litigation strategy as a so-called Stalingrad strategy, and that he regarded me as a propagandist for the NPA. And the court said, you know, he's made it very, very clear in his own words why he wants to silence her with this particular prosecution.
I do want to get into some of the details around this, but I'm really interested in the fact that Jacob Zuma seems to be like Teflon. I mean, the man's he's substantially older than most people in politics get to be. He's still very active. Whether he's being propped up there for the purposes of, you know, family legacy, or whether there are people just jumping off the EFF ship onto the MK ship. I get the feeling that he is a wily old fox, but that he also has the hide of a rhino. He's just able to survive a constant barrage of court cases, accusations, public, you know, kind of, what do we even call it? It's sort of the public throwing him under the bus and blaming him for everything that went wrong over the last 10 years. And while he's responsible for a large part of that, I also get the feeling that this guy is just, he's like a nuclear bomb could go off and he'd survive.
I actually write in the book that, you know, there's kind of a tragedy to him. Because Jacob Zuma did spend 10 years in Robben Island. And when the Rand Daily Mail, I think they interviewed him, not a single person ever visited him. And I know there was one activist who used to send him a birthday card every year. And when he came out, he just said, you know, thank you. That was kind of the only mail that I got, you know. And he, when KwaZulu-Natal, I mean, anyone who knows South African history, when Natal was literally ravaged by violence between the IFP that was being armed by the Apartheid Military Intelligence Division and the ANC, you know, thousands of people died. That was kind of one of the centers of bloodshed in the horrific apartheid story. He was the person who walked into that situation and brokered peace. Mm-hmm. And then when the IFP win the province in the first national elections, he's the guy who's like, no, to the ANC, we mustn't contest this. We've got to accept it. And you go, and there's this interview that they have with him when he's like in his 50s and he's talking about, no, you know, in the next election, he wants to retire because he wants to get a cottage by the sea because he loves the sea. And you go from that to this, like, you know, person who thinks that Barack Obama's CIA attempted to murder him through his wife.
Mm-hmm. This is the poisoning, right?
Yeah, this is the poisoning now. He regards Vladimir Putin as a very close, you know, comrade, et cetera, which is understandable given the history of the Soviet Union supporting the ANC during apartheid. But it's gone beyond this, where he's accused a number of people very close to him of trying to kill him. So the paranoia doesn't just extend to like so-called Western nations. It extends to his inner circle. There are people that he has totally turned his back on because he believes they're part of the Western forces that are stacked against him. And, you know, I've spoken to those people. And Gareth, you will know, like when the rape case was happening, he was surrounded, and the early stages of the corruption case. I mean, look at the people he had around him. It was Zizi Kodwa. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, Bladen Zamande.
Zwaneli Manyi.
Yeah. Well, not Manyi. That's the latest one.
No, Manyi's suddenly come back into the fold. But yeah, you're right. There are all these people like protecting him and surrounding him and supporting him.
And they've all gone. And some of them are his biggest critics. Vavi is outspokenly critical of Zuma. And so, you know, you have this situation where the community that he was in that was backing him into his presidential aspirations has dissipated. And essentially now the MK, you know, has become somewhat of a retirement home for people either implicated in serious corruption, impeached individuals. Removed, you know, first of the democracies, impeached individuals, and with this whole narrative of grievance, and you know, we've been hard done by. This sort of systemic refusal to be accountable or to believe that they can legitimately be held accountable, and this, you know, what's also extremely sad for me is that the MK party's entire ethos is about a return to parliamentary sovereignty. which was the system that allowed the apartheid government to keep jailing Robert Sobukwe.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's
very sad.
If you look at the kind of people who MK proffered to us as their candidate list, I mean, these are all people who've, not one of them has taken responsibility for their role in state capture, for all of the things that happened that we all know are objectively bad things in the country. And these are kind of like the people who did it. And we're expected to believe that they are now going to come in and be cleansed and bring us a new dawn, you know, like Cyril was supposed to at some point. But I do want to ask you, and I know Kath's got some questions for you too, about how it felt to go through it personally and how it continues to perhaps be for you, because these things they create deep scars and maybe they make you less reticent or more reticent, less keen to report on certain things which you know might get you into trouble. And I mean, there is a lot to be said for journalists who are putting themselves on the front line, whether it's in war zones, whether it's reporting on stuff that will get them into personal danger. You don't think that journalists should never appear in court. There are obviously reasons that can happen, right?
Well, I mean, look at Maria Ressa. I mean, that's in the Philippines. And she was, you know, I think that prosecution is still ongoing. But she, you know, anyone who knows about Philippines and the leadership there and the war, the so-called war on drugs that left so many people dead, you know, there was some very good, important journalism that happened there. And one of the journalists who exposed that then got sort of pursued with trumped up charges, some of which have sort of, you know, fallen by the wayside. But, you know, she had to fight like quite a tough battle. And I mean, the bonus of being South African is people will say, look, it was very hard, but I didn't ever have a moment where I thought I'm actually going to go on trial for this. I really didn't believe that because I've been in these courts for so many years. And, you know, we have a democratic system. It's an imperfect system. It has all kinds of shortfalls. But fundamentally, I do believe that we have a constitutional democracy where, you know, the right thing will happen in the end. And I think that my case proved that. And the amazing bonus about it is that we got judgments that already have protected other journalists. You know, the judgment in my case was used in the Moti, you know, the interdict he tried to bring against Amal Bongani or successfully bought was overturned. They cited that judgment. You know, the Alex Mafia trying to interdict, you know, your defamation interdict against my company is 24. So that judgment is useful. And, you know, my case was so completely clear cut that it enabled the courts almost to put in place this protection that I fundamentally believe will help and support a number of other journalists who come after me. And if that's what happened, then it was worth it, you know, then it was definitely worth it.
Well, I'm glad you're not in an orange uniform. I mean, I don't think that would...
No, not to do the Zile Zoom.
No, let's not do that. So I'm sure Kath's got some questions for you too, because this kind of thing has a personal element where you've got to...
Yeah.
We think journalists and we think people in politics and we think people in the news are these extraordinary people who don't have feelings, that don't get like extremely depressed,
yeah,
who aren't vulnerable.
Yeah. I think I just wanted to know, I mean, we obviously all live in South Africa and we have this constant, there's a constant fear driving down the road. I mean, a lot of us have had smash and grabs and all of that. And there's a PTSD that happens constantly in living in this amazing country. And I think I just wanted to understand how being in this situation, putting yourself out there, standing up for what was right, and knowing that people could so easily come and get you, how did you deal with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, you know, I think about there was like a road that I used to drive to the SABC and I had a smash and grab there. And like, it was like the only road that I could get home. And I had to drive that road every single day. And this incredible fear and anxiety that I went through for months driving that road. And that was just like one little instance. This must have been all the time. And I mean, you say you went to your parents in their old age home, which must have been like absolutely massively helpful, but how did you deal with it personally and physically, actually?
Well, I mean, what was insane was like when we were appearing in court, we had to go with bodyguards, and like that was like really that was difficult for me.
Yeah,
because I'm literally like, they came and picked us up from the airport and these guys have got rifles across their chests, you know, like they didn't want us to drive on our own. And I, you know, I mean, I have a very, very strong bond with Billy Downer, and I honestly don't know how I would have survived that experience without him just being as incredibly supportive of me as he was, because I thought he would have every right to be like angry with me because it was my story that resulted in both of us sitting in the dock. And I remember, and he was just fantastic. He just said, you know, you were doing your job, I'm doing my job, we'll just keep going, we'll fight it. Yeah. But there was this, we had these discussions where we would say, well, you know, it's unlikely that someone would actually put a hit on us. They wouldn't be that organized. But you're more worried that someone who is maybe a bit mentally unstable, mentally ill, reads kind of stuff that gets put out on social media, reads the incitement from someone like Judizile Zuma, who was referring to me, said I should be someone's vafy in prison, you know, like, I should be raped in prison.
Yeah, I love the way people just casually throw that in. Like, really nice people who have like a family and they're probably getting ready for Christmas now. They're like, oh, well, I hope you get raped in prison.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
No, I mean, it's insane. It's insane. But you know, we our big fear wasn't necessarily, though we did, there was an occasion where I had to have bodyguards because Sanef became aware that someone had said that I was potentially going to be the target of a hit, and it ended up not being true. But for 2 weeks, I had to go under bodyguards. But our fear was more that, like, some mentally unstable person, you know, stabs you or attacks you. And that's something that I still have to live with, because I've had encounters. Overwhelmingly, South Africans have been extremely supportive, very, very kind, walk up to me in the street, high five, like shake my parents' hands. You know, I mean, we're adorable. I love us. But, you know, I had one encounter with an Uber driver who sort of said to me, "Why does everyone hate you?" And I was like, you know, like, well, you know, and I had to sit there and sort of explain the machinations of the case and sort of get him through all the social media stuff that he'd been following, which was from a certain quarter of the internet. But yeah, it's I did have paralyzing anxiety. I think a lot of the people in our profession are high functioning, highly anxious people. It's just, you know, like a lot of us are like all the time. So part of it wasn't just even the safety stuff. Part of it was like getting therapy and getting help and saying that I was overwhelmed because, you know, I am a type 1 diabetic and I went into serious comas. I mean, my parents had to like inject glucose into me the one night because I went into a coma. And, you know,
how did they deal with this? Because this is always something that's struck me. You know, I'll say something on a show and think nothing of it, and then it turns into a controversy, and that's all good and well, and I'll be expected to deal with it as part of the job. But that's not my parents' responsibility, or my brother or my sister or friends of mine, and now suddenly they're being asked questions about it. Your folks must have been, I mean, very concerned. You know, say to you, why don't you just go and become a high school teacher or something? It's a bit safer.
They never said that. my parents are amazing. I literally, like, I thank God every day for the family that I have. Like, they're literally the best. I think their overwhelming concern was that I was going to die of diabetic complications because of the level of stress I was under, which was a very valid fear, because there were a number of occasions where we had to call, you know, ambulances, and, you know, like, well, I was very, very unwell. And the thing is with diabetes, with type 1, is if you go into a coma, you can die. You know, oxygen starves from your brain, you become incoherent. You get severely brain damaged at a point, and then at a certain point, you'll pass away. And I know diabetic friends who that's happened to. And so it was this collision, you know, of you. And it's so interesting to me, because I think your instinct, you know, what you just said now, Gareth, like, oh, well, you know, I have to take it. You know, I don't know, you know, it's, we don't take it, do we? Like, it affects us. It affects, like, how we view the world. It can make you more fearful. It can make you more apprehensive. It can make you more cautious of interactions with other people. And I think, you know, to this day, though my parents have never, ever made me ever feel bad about being a journalist and doing what I do, I think my greatest sense of guilt or regret is about what I put them through, because they carried me through that, and they shouldn't have had to do that.
I think you answered you gave the solution to the problem in your previous comment, where you said that most people don't think that you're this dangerous journalist who, you know, tried to bring down Jacob Zuma, even though there's some truth to the fact that you were reporting on him and that it didn't redound in his honor. You have never been approached by someone in public who said, you know, you're a terrible person and I hate you. Similarly with me, there can be the biggest internet controversy going on, and I hope I'm past those, frankly, because it's just so, I'm over it.
Yeah.
But I've never had anyone come up to me and say, you know, you are a terrible person or whatever.
Mm.
Because that all happens on social media, which is just not real. It's not a real place.
It's not real. It's not real. And I mean, I'm actually working on another book now, which is about the social media thing.
Mm.
And I think that what they actually want to do with the kind of tide of hatred and whatever is almost radicalize you. And sort of because people, we are in an environment now where we're presented with this idea that our political spectrum is one of extremes, right? You're either on the extreme left or the extreme right. There's no in between. And that's just not true. The most interesting stuff around Twitter, X, is that the vast majority of people on X are actually silent. They're observing, they're watching. And then in between all of that, there are like these screamers that are, you know, like grabbing all this attention. Oftentimes the algorithm will reward particularly controversial or hate-fueled stuff.
Yep.
And, you know, when you talk to people in real life, like the kind of stuff that you'll see on social media is by no means a reflection of what the average South African wants.
Oh, hell no. Yeah. I mean,
all of us want this to work. All of us want this to work. Like, you know, we're not out there, you know, like just wanting to burn everything to the ground, hating the
people screaming, screaming at each other hysterically, like you're wrong and I'm right. And that doesn't happen in real life. I mean, I think
we actually have to, as society, and I think one of the things that helped me survive this was I just didn't take it seriously. We obviously, like, there were a lot of very wounding stuff. There was like direct threats to my life. We scrubbed the internet of any reference to my family because I didn't want anything coming at them. My mother deleted her account, which was most of the time her responding to people she liked and saying amen, exclamation mark. So that was fine. But like, you know, we made some choices. But one of the biggest choices I made was to say, I can put my stories out there. I'm staying on there to put my stories out there, but I'm not getting locked in the mire of this stuff. You know, I really value and appreciate criticism. I think it's extremely important. Like, we have to be able to say, look, I maybe have re-angled this wrong, or maybe there's something I've done differently. That is completely valid. But someone screaming, die, bitch, die at me on the internet is not super helpful. It's not something I need to see. No. And it's not something that should disrupt me from going about my day and doing what I'm called to do, which is to be a journalist.
Yeah.
So JP says, do you think if Billy Downer agreed to Zuma's demands, he would have been in court by now?
No. I mean, in the original special plea application that he bought, he actually said it wasn't just about Downer, it was about any prosecutor associated with Downer, it was about anyone in the NPA. He basically said essentially that no one could prosecute him. I also agree with Downer and the NPA that it's very, very dangerous if we bow to this idea that, oh, let's just give in to this guy's demands that he doesn't want to be prosecuted by this person. Can you imagine, like, the implications for the criminal justice system? Because as soon as you see someone with a modicum of, like, a Johan de Nason or, you know, George Baloy and, you're going to be like, oh, no, or Michelle LaRue, because, I mean, those guys were potentially going to prosecute Steinhoff.
Right.
You're going to be like, oh, no, I don't, you know, I feel this person, whatever, make up something. And then, you know, we get mired in long-winded proceedings. I don't think that's a good idea. And I think the NPA took a principled stance on that, which I think was the correct one. The problem for the NPA was Bulelani Ngcuka's decision with Sheikh, where he didn't put Zuma on trial with Sheikh, which literally changed the entire trajectory of this country. And I think Jacob Zuma is rightfully, you know, he always raises that as an issue and says it was deeply unfair. It was deeply unfair. It was deeply unfair, not just to him, but to the country. Bulelani Ngcuka has defended that decision. Mm-hmm. But in the end of the day, they had a case against both Zuma and Sheikh, and they should have prosecuted them. And we may well be looking at a very different South Africa if they had.
Yeah, I think that we're still looking at a very strange South Africa. And I can't believe that essentially the biggest new party is a party that was established just around the grievances of Jacob Zuma with the system. Mm-hmm. And it received enough support to almost become the provincial government of KwaZulu-Natal, you know, by just a couple of percentage points. And I don't know what you think might happen here. I'd like to just forecast, and knowing as much as you know about the personalities involved, do you think that there's any chance at all that MK kind of is more than just a survival, a testimonial, a kind of a retirement plan for Jacob Zuma. Do you think there's anything else going on there that we don't know? And particularly when it comes to who's pulling the strings, right? Because he does look like a frail old man now. And I don't think he's gone. I don't think he's like Joe Biden levels of gone. But I think that the guy is probably not calling all the shots. He may be calling some of them. Who's there? Is it Duduzile? Who do you, I mean, you still follow these things. You're paying very close attention.
I mean, it is fascinating for me, the dynamics of that party, because anyone who knows the personalities involved, particularly like someone like Dr. John Klope, for example, led the Western Cape High Court. And, you know, there's various allegations around that. But is a very strong personality. And he's now in this leadership position because Jacob Zuma can't be in parliament because of the constitutional court contempt conviction. And I wonder about those dynamics. I wonder about how those two personalities are going to play out, because people who have connections with both of them have said, you know, it's only a matter of time. And then you throw into the mix Floyd,
yep,
who has been a sort of second in command to Julius, so is used to keeping quiet while the diva throws a tantrum because there weren't enough peanuts in the room or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he will probably be fine. Busisiwe Mkhwebane, I'm not sure, you know, what will happen. But then you have Brian Molefe.
Yeah.
You know, you have this whole cast.
It's like a rogues gallery.
It's going to be fascinating to see what happens there. But I mean, I think what the EFF example shows us is that theatrical chaos politics only works for so long, right? Because the average South African does, I think, want solutions, and they want like viable political strategies that can work. And the MK have this grand plan about wanting to, you know, undermine the constitution, go to a parliamentary sovereignty system. They super, you know, obviously as the EFF has also always been very, very much pro Russia, pro BRICS, which is, you know, yeah, fantastic for them. But they have a very firm geopolitical identity.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, outside of, you know, flexing their muscles in that kind of scenario and throwing tantrums about the NPA and state capture, you know, they haven't really presented themselves as a viable political force, you know. I'm interested to see what they do with that.
Did you ever actually have conversations with Zuma? Not obviously once.
Yes, because
that interests me too.
I interviewed him for the nuclear book in March 2019. And, you know, like, this is the thing that's so interesting about him, right? Is like, so he for some reason, knew that I was diabetic. And I was having lunch with him. And we were watching this. Pravin Gordhan was having a press conference on the TV. And, of course, he's, like, glued to what Pravin Gordhan has said because that's, like, his frenemy. And, you know, and in the midst of this, he sort of says, you know, there was this like dessert getting offered. And I was like, well, no, I can't. And he's like, no, we have diabetic ice cream. You can have that. You can have ice cream that doesn't have sugar in it. And I thought to myself, my God, like this man somehow, I don't know if I'd said it or whatever, but he picked that up, remembered it. And then, you know, put me this diabetic ice cream. And he provided a very spirited, sort of motivational for why he believed that we should do a Russian nuclear deal. He somehow, I don't think, realized the seriousness of some of the things that he said. For example, he said, I considered all the deals that were on the table, which I think was America, France, and Russia. And Russia was definitely the best, which, of course, for a president to make those kind of utterances in the context of procurement is really, you know, that's unlawful. You can't do that. But he also, you know, he was very warm. He was inviting. He answered all the questions. The only question he sort of avoided was about his relationship with Vladimir Putin. He didn't want to go into that. He said, you know, many people have relationships with him. And he also didn't want to go into the issue of the poisoning. And then subsequent to that interview, of course, he goes to the state capture inquiry and then lays bare how all these Western / apartheid forces have been trying to kill him.
But I mean, the point that I was getting to is you have these conversations with this guy who pretty much could have sent his actions, his lawyers and his actions could have sent you to jail for 15 years. But so much of politics is performative, right? I mean, you see these guys, they hate each other. It's almost like the social media real life conundrum. On social media, people are horrible to each other. In real life, they're nice to each other. In politics, these guys are vicious and this case is being laid by this one and this one is shouting at that one in parliament. And behind the scenes, they absolutely hate each other. And then when you're not looking, they're shaking hands and laughing and taking the piss out of the whole scenario and saying, oh, almost like these people in South Africa are so stupid. They think we all hate each other, but actually we have lunch every now and then.
Yeah.
Huh?
I mean, remember the height of the private prosecution thing that Zuma tried to do against Ramaphosa at the ANC conference, and there were all these happy pictures of him and Judizi.
Yeah.
So I mean, I can definitely understand that, but I just think it's an intrinsic, you know, human beings are for the most part, they're pretty decent, you know, like we don't want to be in a situation where we're being hateful and unkind to each other. And I think that when we're in each other's physical presence, that oftentimes is the case. Like it's very unusual. I mean, if you have a beef with someone, your instinct is probably just to ignore them and to walk away. And again, that's why I say, just don't buy into the social media thing, because it like no human being can ever be deserving of the kind of vitriol that's sometimes poured out towards them because you think that because they've expressed a certain view, they're a terrible human being and that you need to be horrible to them. They're just a person, in most instances, maybe not all, who's trying their best and maybe has a view that you don't agree with, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you then descend upon them with the force of 1,000 suns. Because you're robbing yourself of the opportunity to have a conversation and a discussion with a real life person rather than shriek at them on a tweet, you know?
Hmm. You very quickly figure out when you're in a situation like this who your actual friends are and who you can rely on and who have never really been there for you. And I think also you can probably take some positives out of this too. I mean, the book would be one of those things, and we can all now share in that story. With the benefit of hindsight, you're able to be a lot more objective about it without being, you know, PTSD'd effectively. Who are the people that you really relied on besides? You've given huge credit to your parents. No doubt they were the biggest players in terms of support. But who else really came to your aid and, you know, deserves some kudos? And what else did you learn from this that helps you to be better at the things you already do so well as a result of having gone through shit?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I always had this perspective that, you know, when you go through real like shit, as you put it, that it'll be people who have their life together, who are, you know, fully in control, who'll come out and back for you and fight for you. But that really wasn't the case. A lot of people, I think, they just saw me as kind of controversial. And so, you know, I used to do a lot of work in TV and radio and stuff. And suddenly, you know, people weren't phoning me to ask me about cases because there would be a lot of unhappiness when I was on by, you know, people posting comments and she's an accused criminal and wada, wada, wada. And it was, there were some, you know, some stations that kept doing it despite that. There was Cape Talk, you know, I will always be grateful for them. But the most amazing thing was the female journalists who get attacked. And one of the strongest levels of support I got was from Polly van Beek, who is a very good friend of mine, who regularly gets it absolutely horrendous abuse because of the exemplary work she's done on the EFF and the Reserve Bank and obviously the VBS scandal.
Yep.
And she, you know, we would go for these walks along the promenade in Sea Point. And she would just, she'd be like, I think you need to go to a painting class. You know, she offered this like very cool like advice of just like keeping that perspective, you know, and she'd like be like, I mute them. And then they can just talk amongst themselves, but I don't have to see it. just mute, Karen, just mute.
Yeah.
She's an amazing, amazing, amazing person. And she came out to bat for me. She regularly came out to bat for me. In addition to all the other abuse she was getting everywhere, she was fighting for me. Feriel Hafiji was another one. Reedy Tlabi, was amazing. And also Kwanita Hunter, who, my erstwhile colleague at News 24, who literally got all our colleagues to do videos on the day that I appeared in court. And it was like, you know, we support you. And it was such a beautiful thing to watch that video. Like when you're about to go into court and your colleagues are like vocalizing their support. And then, you know, there was a demonstration outside the court on the day that we were arguing, and she was there as well talking. And of course, Carl Niehaus came screaming at everyone that they shouldn't be demonstrating.
But isn't he just
one turned his back on him and was like,
isn't he the most ridiculous? He's like the most ridiculous guy in the whole country.
I know, and it's so weird because he posts this tweet about she must be kicked like a dog until the owner comes out, which is something that Iqbal Survey also repeated. And then you see him in public and he runs in the opposite direction. And I'm like, yo, Carl, the dog is here, you know?
Yeah, come and give me a kick.
And yeah,
I interviewed him a while ago, and I kind of felt a bit sorry for him by the end of it, which I didn't think I would. He's like a really sad little man who doesn't have anywhere to go. Like nobody really loves him. He doesn't get along with his family. He doesn't get along with, he's just got nobody. And he kind of jumps into political families because they're the only ones who seemingly will find some use for him. And I kind of felt a bit sorry. I didn't think I would. I felt sorry for the dude. I was like, you're pathetic.
Hmm.
Well, I can kind of understand why the family might be a bit reticent, given the whole, you know, he says that he didn't do it, but there's a well-documented history of him claiming that, you know, relatives were deceased when they were
his mom.
Not dead. Yes. You know, everyone's ask him how his mom is, but his mom has subsequently genuinely passed away. So I don't feel like that's a fair thing to do. But I think also, you know, your actions have consequences. And if you have a dynamic of your personality that is prepared to say false things, for self-serving purposes, or to attack people for self-serving purposes, then it's not a strange thing that you would be sort of isolated. And sometimes there's a context in which, you know, ultimately you're your own barrier towards the life that you want, because we all have to take responsibility. And so I really hope he does one day, because I think he'll probably have a way better life when he does that.
So are you flying to Russia to go and pick a fight with Vladimir Putin next? I mean, you're so... you're so ready for the next... You're so ready for the next challenge.
I don't feel like some ricin or some Novichok, you know, in my coffee in the morning.
Yeah.
Not fun.
Polonium 234.
No, I don't think that's that important. I think he's got bigger fish to fry. You know, he's quickly phoning Trump and Elon Musk, allegedly. So no, I think Putin's probably got bigger fish to fry than me. I'd love to go to Russia though. I think it's such an interesting country and I'm obsessed with it, but I don't know that I actually go and travel there.
All right. So what are you doing for fun now? I mean, you're writing books, but a lot of that's work for you as well. So what are you doing for fun? You can't just go and visit your parents in the retirement village.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I have a very unfortunate habit of watching fast-forwarded dessert videos of things I can't. That's my comfort video on YouTube. Like, I love that. I love that shit so much. And everyone's like, but you're a diabetic. And I was like, yeah, but when the cream and the sugar comes together, it's amazing. Oh. And they're like, dude, you need help. So I might actually go into making actual cakes that I will then give to people, which I'll never be able to eat. But yeah, I mean, mostly, and I'm researching this other book.
Yeah.
And then I also have small members of my family, which I think you do too. And the small members are very good at giving you some perspective on life,
because
they have their head screwed.
So possibly Karen Moore and Cake Boss next time we speak to you, right?
Yes, no, it's going to happen. the diabetic version of cake.
Or you could join. Absolutely. You could join Kath. She's doing like yoga. She's got a goddess room in her house.
Yeah,
now.
I do pottery.
Yeah, pottery.
It's
listen
really,
to this.
Really important.
I want to do the pottery. I think I'm very Kath. I'm in your DMs for the pottery. Now.
Absolutely. I'm gonna message you back because it is the most therapeutic thing, and I've learned so many things. You've got to let go. The clay is actually telling you what it needs to be. I know you're gonna say it's a hippie vibe, Gareth.
No, I just
but
feel
it's
like I've suddenly the show's okay. Become the sisterhood of the traveling pants or whatever the fuck that thing is.
Well, I just wanted to say how amazing, like all the people that you said like that stood by you were all of these amazing, strong women. And I think that we often find that you know, women can be so detrimental to each other. And the fact that they all banded together to be with you is just such an incredible testament to them, to you. And oh, I get goosebumps just thinking about it because as women, we are so damn powerful. And when we are together and we work together, God, no one can stop us. And I just love that. Awesome. And I'm so excited to buy your book because I'm going to buy it for my book club. And I'm, oh, it's amazing. It's really so fantastic.
I'm thrilled. Listen, well done on the book, and it's great to talk to you again. Next time you're in Joburg, come and sit here for a change rather than this internet thing. You
not know, in the Retirement Village, but Retirement Village aesthetic. I mean, it's added a dimension to your show that you would
No, it's very cool. Absolutely. It's very cool. I mean, we get to go into your parents' house, which normally wouldn't happen. Thanks so much, yeah. Karen, and well done on the book. It is called I Will
Thank
Not
you
Be
so
Silenced.
Much.
And yeah, you and Kath get together and do this pottery. And
we're actually gonna get you involved, Gareth. Yeah. You just come to the pottery class.
No, it sounds like a feminist that you guys do it.
Beautiful pot ever.
Yes.
Gareth will become an avant-garde pot artist that will literally rival Banksy. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
Kath, it's going to happen.
It is. I mean, baby steps. I'm getting him to write in a journal for
now.
Yeah.
She's got me convinced I need to do journaling all of a sudden. So before I actually become a feminist on this show, let me just stop it right now. It's 8 o'clock. We're about to call it quits for the day. Thank you very much, Karen Morn. Very big thank you to you, Catherine Grenfell, for coming to spend time
with
us.
So lovely. Thank you for asking me.
This was fun.
It was nice to be here.
And keep doing all this good hippie shit.
Thanks, man.
Look after yourself.
I am.
We like you. We want you to stick around.
Thank you, Gareth.
All right. And Karen, we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
Cheers,
awesome.
Karen.
Thanks, guys. That's us. We will see you on Wednesday at 6 a.m. Bye.